And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park.
Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. These are the Conspiracy Queries. I am the Alan Park, and we are sinking deeper and deeper into winter. Yeah, at least we are where I live, in Canada. Yes, Canada. You might have heard of us. We're the nice guys. Oh, we'll help you out. You know, we'll help you cross the road. When you've got a lot of packages and you're an old lady, we'll do all kinds of nice things. We go to, you know what, if you're from a different part of the world and you don't know Canadians, you know what we like to do a lot? I'll tell you. We like to go and get some sort of substandard, I guess I'd say, baked goods at this store called Tim Hortons, which is the guy's name, Tim Horton, you know, you can't blame him for that. And then he's got a donut chain of stores where he sold donuts and coffee. This guy used to be a hockey player a long time ago. So yeah, Canada, hockey, donuts, coffee. And then this guy died. And the next thing you know, Tim Hortons is the biggest thing in the world. And they've just merged with Burger King, one of the crappiest outlets of GMO garbagey steak and meats ever. Ugh, God. And all they're trying to do down there is they're just trying to avert their taxes, you know, so they're going to gobble up the stupid little Canadian company that everybody prays to. You know how you can't make fun of religion sometimes? They get offended. Well, if you make fun of a Tim Hortons to a guy that's sitting in there with some flaps on his ears and a pair of boots at 5:17 in the morning and make fun of Tim Hortons, he'd probably punch you in the face. Yeah, but this is the reason I tell you this is because now it turns out Burger King trying to get out of some corporate American taxes, which isn't necessarily a bad thing in itself. He's what they've trying to do down there is they've merged, they've acquired. I guess it's an aggressive merger or some kind of thing, basically. Cut the donut shop in half and drink it in. So now I don't know what to call it. Do we call it King Hortons or do we call it Burger Tim's? Well, a lot of Canadians didn't seem to mind too much or pay attention to it. And then the next thing you know, the following week after the announcement that the deal goes through, apparently the coffee that they sell is going up 10 cents a glass and everybody's upset. 10 cents a cup, I should say. Yeah. Yeah. See, I don't even drink coffee at Tim Hortons. And neither will you anymore. But you will. You will. It's just another Canadian company swallowed up by another American company, because we have the leader that makes all that kind of stuff happen, Stephen the Pimple Harper, in this corner, weighing in on reality with the most ridiculous position on everything, Stephen Harper. This guy, I got to tell you, folks, we are stuck with this. You know, it's not nice. Sometimes people think if you make fun of somebody or criticize them or insult them that you lose the argument. But he's not here today. What a piece of work this guy's. Not really going to be an argument. Just going to be me going off on Stephen. Stephen likes to sign secret trade deals with China so that later when we over here with our trade deal sort of do something wrong, China can sue us and we can't sue them. This guy, Stephen Harper, might as well be Chinese. He might as well be wearing a little Chairman Mao suit and running around. Maybe we could get some Grecian formula on his Lego head and sort of put it back to black. He'd look exactly like... Well, he'd look exactly like one of his old ministers, Bev Oda. But that's another story. That's another story. Listen, the thing is, I've been goofing around lately because a lot of you people, and I mean that, when I say it, I mean it, you and people, a lot of you people have been asking me, hey, where's the next show? What's happening? We've had some irregularities in the flow of release. And I admit to this. It's been a difficult time lately trying to keep this together. It's a very small operation. On this end, just a few people, you know, at our end, and then coming at us serious. And then, you know, all of a sudden, there's been a lot of pressure lately in this particular corner, politically and medically and time-wise. And yeah, I've had a few phone calls that I will be sharing with you shortly on subsequent shows. But today, before we get further into what's happening right now, I got to tell you about my guest. His name is Tom J. Kennedy. And Tom is a fantastic Canadian guy, and he's going to tell you all about the problems with usury. Oh,
don't change the station. Don't change it. Don't change the station. I know it sounds boring, but it's the reason a lot of us actually need to have three jobs. Usury is this. It's in the Bible. You can look it up. But basically, usury is interest. And interest is a fake thing that wasn't there on top of money. Like, if I lend you 10 bucks and then say, yeah, you can pay me the 10 bucks back, but actually pay me 12. And then you're stupid enough to go, okay. And then we keep doing that and we keep rolling it over. And that's why right now it costs about $3 to buy a chocolate bar. And when I was a kid, it was a quarter. And when I was a kid and it was a quarter, people were telling me when I was a kid, it was a nickel. So on and on it goes. It's going to end sometime. And hopefully our prime minister in this country will be gone long before that happens. Why am I so mad at this guy? Well, you know, this Harper, I mean, he's done a lot of weird stuff. First of all, he was an economist out in the West, and then he basically stole a party and said he wouldn't change it to the party that it is, and then had it changed to the party that it is. And I'm only breaking it down this slowly and, without too much description for our not Canadian listeners. But basically, this guy is super dangerous. I mean, how many more CETA kind of trade contracts can he sign? How many more types of things can he do to take things out from us? Well, I'm going to tell you a lot about it next week because we're heading into the Christmas season, and nothing would please me more than to wake up one Christmas morning and find out that this particular guy has more than just a few people aware of the stuff that he gets up to. Oh, he gets up to all kinds of things. Oh, he does. And we've got a lot of things going on here in Canada. You know, people tell us we're boring, but we got guys running around the Parliament building. No problem. No problem, by the way. There was a shooting at a soldier's memorial, and that was tragic. And then several minutes later, apparently, even though that happened in the middle of Ottawa, in the middle of our capital city, in the middle of a place where there are cameras everywhere, this guy manages to leave murdering a soldier, leave that scene, managed to get away. No problem. Yeah, nobody saw him do it, apparently. And then he, except for the cameras, that they won't show us. And then he drove somehow, got to the Parliament buildings, where he was able to run in there with a gun, no problem. Oh, yeah, no problem. And so, and then go in there and took a bunch of shots at people, apparently. And, you know, God, it was a real scene in there. And in fact, the CBC, one of Canada's national broadcasters, or maybe the only one, or maybe the only private one, or maybe the only public one, depending on what floor you're in, they actually ran a story, Evan, about the shooter sort of rolling around and shooting up into the wall. And we've got us a hero in this Vickers fella. He's a guy that actually shot the shooter and took him down. Only trouble is there's a blog up, and I'll put it on the website. I'll put it on the show later. You'll see it, where the bullet holes that the shooter shot into the wall there a few weeks ago are actually captured in a photograph of another fella who visited Parliament Hall last year, April 2013, and he's got a photograph of that very same panel with a picture frame on it, and around it are those same holes that have been there for a long time that have been purported to be bullet holes from the recent attack. So it's more garbage. It's more 100-story buildings falling to the ground in 10 seconds with no reason. And the next day, Harper puts into effect a motion and a series of laws that are going to whip into place another tightening of the security state. And it's amazing to me that anybody out there still believes this idiot and still allows him to get away with it. I think that time is coming to an end, and I hope that it happens while I'm still alive. I really do. But that's a matter for another day. And right now, let's go to our interview. Tom, I have to say, I've been doing this show for about a year and a half now on Sirius, and it's going well, and it's getting good response, and that's, you know, wonderful and everything, but gosh, it's getting a little bit expensive out there now, and I think maybe I need a raise. And you know what? I had a raise before, and I need more money now. But before, the money I had was okay, but now I need more to do the same thing, and so I have to ask for it. So why is that, Tom?
Well, the orthodox economic system of debt money is part of the problem, and it's the way it's designed. The function of interest creates the shortage, because when we go to get a loan, and let me do the very micro example. If you go get a loan for $10 and the interest rate is 10%, that means you got to pay back 11. But the bank only issues the 10% as the principal. And so if you understand what's going on, all of the debtors are out there in the marketplace scrambling, maybe lying a little bit, cheating a little bit, being a little bit greedy to make up the principal plus the interest, because they got to pay back the banker the principal plus the interest. and only their principal is in the marketplace.
So this is the fundamental core of what usury means.
That's the fundamental core of usury, and all the holy books say thou shalt not take usury of another man. But in this 21st century, if I ask 10 people what the word usury means, 9 of them never heard the word. But anything above 0% should be correctly defined as usury.
Okay, and this is, as you say, in all the religious books, such as?
Such as the Bible, the Quran, and the old religious books, all of them. All of them forbid usury.
And the Talmud as well, like the Jewish books as well?
As far as I know, yes.
Wow. Okay, so how does a banker, say, in our modern world, who is either calls himself a devout Christian or a devout Jew, how do they be a banker? How can they... Well, how can you be a banker and a religious person and live in your own skin? I mean, these are the people at the helm here.
I guess because they don't know they don't know. And formal education neglects to teach these topics, and they just learn what the economics books textbooks teach them in their university classes, and they come out understanding or thinking that interest is a function of our debt money system that must be there, and they don't have any other standing otherwise.
Okay, so then maybe that's why that happens. But then as a devout, understood, believing Christian, you should know very well what the definition of usury means, and it should ring alarm bells that, hey, that's what I'm paying all the time. That's what, you know, or that's what I'm charging as a banker. How can I do this? How can I be a devout Christian or a devout Jew and charge interest? I mean, you know, you can't – that's a real disconnect there. And so what you're saying is true. That's a fundamental disconnect that could speak to the magnitude of the problem we're now suffering financially.
Well, I guess the churches have all been subverted, and they're all part of the economic infrastructure, and they all get government discounts or government – they don't have to pay tax to certain government authorities, and so they don't want to challenge anything because then they'd stand out like a sore thumb. That's what I understand. I've been sending letters to clergy since I learned about this in the early 1980s, and rarely do I get any more than a form letter back, and no church group of any organization has actually addressed the function of usury. They just refuse to address it.
Really? Wow. They seem to be pretty hopped up on some other alleged indiscretions, but you don't, they don't get too wound up about the fundamental linchpin that's ruining our world.
Huh. And some of the key researchers will tell you that usury is the fifth column, and in Greek architecture, the fifth column is the hidden column. So usury is defined as the fifth column that's holding all the other part of their infrastructure up, and they don't want to talk about it. But more and more people are talking about it, and more people are becoming awake. And when I started this research in 1980, I was like a lone wolf in the wilderness, but there's a lot more out there now, a lot more people researching it, writing about it, and talking about it.
Okay, well, let's just run it through the sieve one more time. What you've said off the top is that if you go to borrow money from a bank, say $100, then as you go to pay it back, you now have to pay more because of the interest, and that act is usury. And so at that point, is that right?
That is correct.
That is right. Okay, so I borrow 100 and now I have to pay back 105 or whatever. And so that money never really existed in the first place. We could talk about that as well, and we'll have to. But even if it did, I have to give back 105, which is more than, and then so everyone's doing that. And so basically we're always constantly repaying back more money than already exists.
Yeah, we're scrambling in the marketplace as debtors and consumers trying to earn enough to pay back the principal plus the interest, or the usury as I call it, when only the principal is created by the banker and issued at the time of the loan or mortgage. And mortgage, by the way, is an interesting word. Mortgage is mort for death and gage for gamble. So it's a death gamble, if you really want to translate it into French. And it's curious, in the French language, they don't use the word mortgage, even though it's a French word. They use the word apothèque. Because I guess the French people would figure it out. They'd know it was a death gamble if they called it mortgage.
Huh, that's fascinating. Yeah, different etymological clues here and there in different languages as to what words really mean. Very fascinating. So, yes. Okay, so you found out about this exactly how?
Well, let me go back to 1980. In 1980, I was 32 years old. I was born in 1948, and I was like any other common Canadian citizen. I was married. I had two young children, and a family man, and I was a school teacher. And lo and behold, one day in a used bookstore, I picked up a book titled None Dare Call It Conspiracy, authored by Gary Allen.
Gary Allen. Yes, that is on the web. But I should say, just a quick commercial here. Check the reading list on the conspiracyqueries.com website. You'll see there's a reading list, and that book is definitely on it. Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, Gary Allen authored that in 1971, a little book with just 135, 140 pages, a little paperback, and it was retailing for $1. I picked it up in a used bookstore for about 10 cents back then. And when I was reading it, I was saying to myself, hey, this stuff can't be true. And I was setting out in my research to prove Gary Allen was wrong, because I was subservient to the whole authority at that time.
Were you incensed when you read Gary's book? Were you like, hey, this guy's wrong, and I'm kind of angry about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I was setting out to do my research to prove he was wrong. And the more research I did, the more I figured out he just touched the edge of the iceberg, tip of the iceberg, and that there was a lot more to this world politics and power than I had ever learned in school. And I kept digging and digging and finding out more and more. So here we are now, like 34 years later, and every day I still learn how little I know.
Well, that's how you know you're not insane, because when you think you know it all, then I don't want to talk to you at all.
So anyway, so then that was back in 1980. And then shortly after that, a couple of years after that, 82 or 83, I met a gentleman from Ottawa here, John Trammell. And I believe I introduced you to him last week, and he'd probably be a very interesting guest at some future date.
Yes, yes.
John was living in Ottawa at the time, and I heard him call a radio talk show and talk about money and banking and interest and usury. And the radio talk show host kind of mocked him and laughed at him. And at this point in time, I was at the mind state that when I heard somebody that made sense to me, but he was being mocked or laughed at by somebody in mainstream media, I'm going to find that personality, meet him face to face, and figure out myself if this man is onto something or if he is, in fact, worthy of being laughed at.
Right.
So I did. I searched out John Trammell. I found him. And I got to tell you, he's been one of my best mentors about understanding economics, money, banking, usury, and solution-oriented stuff. Yeah, John's an amazing character and, one of my best mentors over the last 32 years.
Well, that's great. Well, yes, I will be contacting him and have him on the show at some point for sure. So that's great. So how are you dealing with the fact that, you know, when you walk down the street and talk to people, still, most people don't even know what that word is. They're not sure. They haven't read about it. They don't know what it means. I mean, to me, it feels like the level you're at right now with exposing the fraud of usury is kind of, to get the common awareness to this is, reminds me of people in the 70s, you know, trying to talk about pollution.
Well, I guess one of the first things that when I figured out the problems associated with usury and it's indirectly or directly causing poverty, scarcity, lack, and it even can be connected to things like wars and violence. So I had the problem in my face, and then I said, well, let's look at solution-oriented stuff. So that was back in 1983. I first learned about Michael Linton, a gentleman living in Vancouver Island, and he created the first LETS software. LETS stands for Local Employment Trading System. And if you recall back in the early 80s, interest rates spiked as high as 21%. People were losing their homes, losing their businesses, out of job, no money to pay them. And that's when Michael Linton, in his community in Comox Valley, British Columbia, he set up this LETS software program where people could make a list of things they offered to the community and a list of things they were looking for or the requests.
So a barter system, basically.
Yeah, a barter system. And he called this first usury-free community currency, he called it green dollars. And what struck me about this community currency idea is that the function of interest was taken out of the equation. Therefore, if your account was negative, you were never charged interest. And if your account was positive, you were never paid interest or usury on your account. So when you took interest out of the equation, it changed the whole playing field for the economic community. And that was back in 82, 83. And so that concept has been evolving, and there's been hybrids created since. And it's spread around the world, actually, since. So now we got communities all around the world that are teaching people to shop local, buy local, and use community currency in their local exchanges, trades, negotiations, or whatever. So, and mainstream media is basically ignoring the whole movement so far.
What movement?
Well, I call it the usury-free community currency movement.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's why, you know, I haven't heard of it until I came across speaking with you. And, of course, I've known about you for a while researching, but pretty much, I mean, this isn't in any kind of paper. This is nowhere.
No.
And so the better hidden it is, I always think, the more important it is.
Yeah, and the internet has been a really great tool for us in this movement because we're well connected on the internet with various groups, and that's how we find each other and support each other. So yeah, it's been a tool for our motivation and for growing our movement.
Right. Okay. Well, we're speaking with Tom Kennedy, and we're speaking about usury or usury. I'll have to talk with. We'll have to get the straight up goods on exactly how to pronounce that as soon as we come back. You're listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park on Sirius XM channel 167. We'll be right back. Okay, Tom, we're back, and thanks for sticking around. So you have a Facebook page, and you're trying to get this word out about usury. And how do you pronounce it? Is it usury? I mean, I can't even.
It's pronounced usury, just the way it spells. U-S-U-R-Y, usury.
Usury. Yeah. Okay, I was called it usury. I don't know why. Anyway, okay. So the thing that I want to know is, if we get this message to people, how does that look to you? What is going to happen? Because to me, basically what I see is if I expose the reason why you need three jobs, that's more important than you doing three jobs and claiming you don't have time to understand the reason why you have to do three jobs. Do you know what I mean?
I understand. I don't know. Let me give you another gentleman in the movement that I would recommend for a future guest to also, Wayne Walton. Wayne Walton lives in Summit County, Colorado, and he launched a usury community time currency in that area 2 years ago. And I don't know. You know how Colorado is kind of the open-minded state of the West, and it's curious out there now because. It's a growing concept in Summit County, Colorado, and I kind of chuckle and laugh because we used to joke here in the eastern part of Canada and say, when we can get the masses using community currency to negotiate trades for bread, beer, and marijuana, we'll have scored the masses. Well, indeed, in Colorado, they're using community currency out there, a community currency called Mountain Hours. And they're negotiating trades for beer, bread, and marijuana, plus many other things. So they're kind of the poster town of the movement and making great strides and moving it ahead.
Hmm. That's incredible. And so is there any reaction from provincial or local – that would be state authorities or federal authorities down there?
It's quite legal to have a community currency. I can't speak about the particular laws in Colorado because I don't know them, but I can speak about here in Ontario and Canada. To my knowledge, there's only one bulletin published by Canada Revenue Agency, and a bulletin is not a law. It's just a bulletin. And they published that in the late 1980s after the LET systems got functioning. And they simply said in that bulletin, I'll just summarize it. Basically, if you're using the community currency to trade articles at garage sales or yard sales, well, they're not going to police that. But if you were a business and you were using the community currency in your business, they wanted the business to treat it like cash and pay your tax on the trades like cash. That's their bulletin. Now, I guess the movement isn't big enough yet to make a law, so there's no law about it. But certainly, some businesses are using community currencies, and that's the teaching: treat it like cash and pay your tax on it like cash.
Hmm. And have there been any kinds of clashes? What I'm getting to is, you know, they had the people that decided they wanted to drink their own organic milk have that headquarters raided. A couple of years ago, because you're not allowed to do that, apparently. Yes. And yeah. That kind of, has there been a forceful reaction?
No, to my knowledge, there's been no forceful reactions. And I guess the movement isn't big enough yet to to make any red flags go up. But let me tell you this little experiment. 2 or 3 years ago, myself and some other members in this movement, we actually had our community currency accounts, and we donated community currency to a charitable organization. And I probably be fair to leave that organization unnamed at the moment.
Why?
Anyway, we donated like $100 of community currency to the organization, a charitable group, duly registered.
Sort of like a United Way type of thing or something like that.
And we got our receipt for that donation. And of course, the charitable organization was able to use the money for little things they wanted to buy from other people in the network. And they gave us the receipt. And myself and the other folks that did this as an experiment filed our receipts, and they got processed in our income tax returns. Now, whether they got processed by accident or whether they got processed with the knowledge that it was community currency, we don't know. But I just know that that 1 year it got processed. And I maintain that there's no reason why any level of government couldn't accept our community currency as partial payment for any bill or taxes, because every level of government has contracts with local entrepreneurs, and they could simply take that community currency and pay it back to the local entrepreneurs who are involved in the community currency movement with their trades and exchanges. So we need to push the envelope with these levels of government and insist that they accept community currency at par with cash. There's no reason why they can't. We could set up government accounts, municipal, provincial, and federal, and when we pay our taxes, we could pay so much in cash and so much in community currency, and then they could turn around and use it for their contracts. Oh. Absolutely.
Okay, now let's look at the other side of things. If things can continue as they are, with interest rates, you know, going up and prices going up, and now it's $500 for a jug of milk, you know, if we don't get turned around on usury, what do you see happening? I mean, at some point there has to be a snapping point.
Well, yeah, this balloon cannot go on forever and ever. It's destined to bust or collapse the way it's set up. So,
In the collapse of 07 and 08, with the packages that were collapsing and the false values that were put on everything, still didn't hear much at all or any of the word usury in there, even though that was also the underpinning of all of the other horrendous spider web of dark deals that were being made that caused the collapse.
It was never discussed. But I mean, we those of us in this movement, we refer to it as an economic lifeboat to have ready for launch when their usury Titanic goes down. And I don't know when it's going to go down, but people doing the research say that it can't go on forever. It's got to go down because the usury portion keeps growing. The usury portion of the debt is the killer machine. And most of our taxes that they take for income taxes doesn't go for services. It goes straight for debt service. And debt service means interest payment on debt, which is usury payment on debt. And when people grasp that concept, then they wake up and say, yeah, this cannot continue.
Well, how did we wind up making ourselves allegiant to some sort of high-paying interest rate? We used to have a lower interest rate.
Yeah, it's fluctuated. I mean, it went as high as 21% in 1981, and now they've lowered it down again. When they lower it down, people they borrow more and more, and they get into debt. And then if and when they raise it again, people are going to be losing their businesses, homes, and they're going to be back in financial trouble.
Hmm. Yeah, this is amazing. So what do you do about it, Tom? You travel around, and you were just in, where was it, London? Ontario, or
let me go back to last week.
Okay.
Last week, between November the 13th and the 19th, we celebrated our 10th annual usury free week. And go back to the history of that. We had our first annual free week in Tamworth, Ontario. Why Tamworth, Ontario? Well, I had a 34-year teaching career, and when I retired from my teaching career, I moved back to my hometown in rural eastern Ontario called Tamworth, Ontario. And I had been studying this research then. I retired in 2000, so I had been studying this research then for 18 years. And my friends and people said, well, why don't you launch a community currency in your own hometown, Tom? So we did. We launched a community currency in Tamworth called Tamworth Hours in November of 2004.
Tamworth Hours.
Tamworth, Ontario. And we launched this currency called Tamworth Hours. And we made 1 hour of time valued at equivalent to $12 Canadian funds. That's for basic, unskilled, or we call it student labor. So, for the example, if you were a plumber in that town and the plumber said, well, the free market pays me $48 an hour, then I'd round that off and say to them, well, if you work in my pipes, I'll pay you 4 hours of Tamworth time for your 1 hour of work. Or the plumber could answer back and say, well, no, I don't want to take 100% Tamworth hours. I'll take 50-50. So he might say, I'll take 50% cash and 50% Tamworth hours. So then in that case, I'd give him $24 in cash, and I give him 2 Tamworth hour notes valued at $12 each. So you understand? So he's getting his full $48 value. Now, why would he take those 2 Tamworth hour notes of $12 each? Well, because he has a list or a database of other businesses in the community that accept them. So he knows he can go to those other businesses, whether it's for business needs or personal needs or family needs, and he can negotiate trades for products and services and spend that Tamworth hours in the ratio that the other entrepreneur accepts. You understand?
I do. I think CRA and IRS probably do as well. I'm sure driving them crazy just thinking about this.
Yeah. But that is so incredible, because I'll tell you what happens. A lot of businesses, they're so jaded about things that have happened over the last 25, 30 years that they're skeptical. And they'll say, well, some will say, yeah, it's a good idea, Tom. They'll say, come back when you've got 500 businesses on your list so I have a bigger choice. And I'd answer back to them, no, sir, we need you to get on the list now to build our list up to that so that it's got more choice. So sometimes it's been hard to convince people.
To get it out of the gate.
But yeah. Let me say this. When they do understand it, and when some of the skeptical ones come on and they say, well, let me just come on at 10%. I'll take 10% community currency and 90% cash. But when they find out they can spend it, then they get more excited. And then they say, okay, now I'll take 20%, 25%, or whatever.
But does it become kind of fun even at that point?
It does. And then ultimately we tell them, all you got to do to be safe is cover your wholesale costs in cash and take whatever percentage of your profit margin is comfortable with you in the community currency. And sometimes people will like go right up to their, if they're paying 60% wholesale and their 40% markup, they'll take the full 60% in cash and take the full 40% in the community currency. And then we teach what I call the back-end teaching. Listen, because you're able to use community currency this month, which you didn't know about last month, and you were able to use it for $200 for personal, family, business needs, that must mean you did not use $200 of federal cash this month, right?
Right.
So we tell them, take that $200 federal cash you did not use this month and pay off debt, whether it's personal loans, mortgage, car loans, anything, because it's the interest or the usury on your debt that's causing you the financial pain. And once they grasp that, then they're on board. But it takes a little bit of while for them to really grasp that.
So ultimately, with the grasp of that attained by many or most of us, or, you know, ideologically all of us, someone's going to start making a lot less money? Is that how it's going to, you know, when we all sort of understand the power and the awareness and the wrongness of having a usury system, and we demand, you know, equality? I mean, this is going to rock the foundations of everything financial globally.
Yeah, as soon as they grasp that, they're going to switch. They're going to say, why should I go to a bank and use their money and pay them a fee usury when I know that I can now create and spend my own money for free in this local community?
Yeah.
So once the light goes on.
Well, that does bring me to the question again of why we are already doing that, because, you know, Canada used to borrow from the Bank of Canada, and it was a pretty sweet interest rate, as I recall, somewhere in the 1% zone. And then somehow they decided, no, let's not do that. Let's pay way more to these foreign banks. And they're paying far more interest to international banking families.
Yeah. And our parliament in Canada has the right to create the money interest for your usury free. But they have given that right away to the commercial banks, and they're paying usury on the debt. And it's insane. It's absolutely insane. But they're not listening.
The thing, though, that thing fascinates me, because that will, on the model that they've laid out, and if people like you don't interfere with solution-based things like this, it's unsustainable. Like, if you look down the barrel of that, it's like looking down the side of a hockey stick or something, and see if it's warped. And you can see way down in the end, it's unsustainable. And so I always try to figure out, well, what is that going to look like? Because it just can't it just can't stay together like that.
No, and the numbers are almost unbelievable when you talk about the billions and trillions that's owed in interest or usury, and it's just not payable. And there used to be a thing in history where they called it Jubilee, where every 7 years they forgave the debt and started over again. And that concept has been like buried and lost.
I guess it has. Oh, the Jubilee. That's funny. So just every 7 years, roll it over. Well, I kind of think that's really what it is, because, you know, I find myself at my age now laughing to myself at how funny it is. I'm right in the sweet spot of my kids, you know, telling my kids, you know, when I was a kid, chocolate bars were only 25 cents. And they're like, what? They can't believe it, because they're $2.50 now or whatever they cost. And of course, then when I was a kid, I remember, you know, that my folks around me saying, wow, a quarter. When I was a kid, chocolate bars were only a nickel. You know,
yeah.
It's just like, so eventually, if this thing keeps going, somebody's going to be saying, wow, when I was a kid, chocolate bars were only $500. Now they're $725. Wow. You know, like at some point, you just have to push the reset button.
Yeah. And looking at real estate is another one to look at, because I'm 66 now, okay, and I got kids in their 30s, and this younger generation in their 20s and 30s, they're hardly able to buy a home now. Like, it was easy to buy a home back in the 1970s, but now it's not so easy, you know. They're coming out of university with 35, 45, 50,000 debt loads already, and then if they want to get married and have a family and looking at buying a home, they can't afford to buy a home.
Yeah, right? That's the problem. Everybody's getting shepherded into university college debt right away. As soon as they're into it, like, here, get yourself deeply in debt for your student loan itself, and then also probably a credit card for all of your running expenses.
Yeah,
and
the first week in September all the time, all the credit card companies are in the universities, like giving them all credit cards with $1,000 or $2,000 limits of credit, and they're signing up for it, not knowing what they're really doing.
And
you
just
know?
Sharks around the chum. Oh, yeah. It's disgusting.
It is.
Well,
it wasn't like that in the 1970s.
No. No, it wasn't. It wasn't like that yet. Right now we're going to step away and take a little break. We're
okay.
Speaking with Tom Kennedy on Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park, Channel 167. Okay, we're back with Tom Kennedy. And Tom is usury-free. Tom, tell us where we can read some more stuff about you. You have a blog, is that right?
Yeah, I think I'll start off telling you about my moniker. My moniker is usury-free. And I want to just explain how I picked that up. Way back in 2002, I was at a conference in Toronto, and there was a guest speaker. His moniker was Johnny Liberty, and he was talking about liberty and freedom. And one of the gentlemen sitting beside me, he knew that I had been talking about usury already in the 1980s. And he said, Tom, since his name is Johnny Liberty, I'm going to call you Tommy No Usury. So that moniker kind of stuck for a couple of years, Tommy No Usury. And then I was at a conference in British Columbia in 2003 or 2004, and a gentleman out there was talking about the power of words, negative words and positive words. And he was pointing out, if you have any kind of word like no or not in your word, it still has a little bit of a negative notation.
Right.
He said to me, Tommy, why don't you consider switching from no usury to usury free? So I listened and I accepted. And so since that time, my moniker has been Tommy Usury Free Kennedy. And I kind of like that, because I understand the difference between the negative and the positive. So usury free is the more positive way of
saying, getting the message out. Well, that's great. So that's your moniker, and that is where we can find you on Facebook, etc.
Yeah. So on Facebook, Facebook was born in 2004, and I just kind of ignored it till 2007. And then even my own children, my children said, Dad, why don't you post some of your stuff on Facebook? So I opened an account in 2007, and very quickly I just started, like, at that time the students were all using it for a social interaction. You know, there was nothing going up that was very much educational. So immediately I started posting information about what I understood about usury money banking and usury free solutions. And very quickly it was spread around by word of mouth and word of mouth. And I didn't do any shopping for friends, but I hit my 5,000 friends rather quickly. So I have my Facebook profile page is Tom J. Kennedy, in brackets, Tommy Usury Free Kennedy. And I also set up two more things on Facebook. There's one page called the Usury Free Network. And there's another new one I set up in 2013 called the Usury Free SDI University. Now, I think I should explain a little bit about that, because SDI stands for self-directed income. And self-directed income refers to all those entrepreneurs out there who are earning their living through sales and marketing or any kind of home-based business that involves them not having employees, because that's kind of another interesting concept, to work without employees, to work by yourself or to have contracts. So anyway, that phrase, self-directed income, and the idea that twinning some usury-free concepts with that is for this reason, that industry, network marketing, I don't know whether you know much about that or not, but it is a growing industry. It's becoming more popular. There's
network marketing.
Network marketing, yeah.
Okay.
Web-based businesses selling products, yeah. Services, whatever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are there's 96 million people globally in that industry. There's 16 million people in that industry in USA and about 1.6 million in Canada. And it's a growing industry as the economic situation out there and when people lose their jobs as employees, they look for opportunity, and this is the industry that they're looking at. Now, okay. Why did I choose that industry to twin with usury-free community currency? Because everybody in that industry has access to products and services at wholesale prices. And so my idea is these people understand, if they understand network marketing, that they can get access to a product at a wholesale price, then they can sell it at a retail price and they can take community currency for their markup. So, and some people in these networks, with the click of a mouse, you can contact hundreds or thousands of people. So to me, it's a real good educational tool or network to spread the knowledge. And so that's why I set up the Usury Free SDI University, and it's gaining some attention now. And more people are coming there to learn what I'm talking about. And at some point, I expect some of these companies will embrace the idea, because you might have 1,000 people in your network. And not only are they connected with one service or product, they also have other talents and skills they can offer. So my message is to these people, get your people in your network to list their talents, skills, other products besides the one company you're connected with, and get people bartering and trading, negotiating and shopping within our own loyal network, so that we spend less and less money with those giant transnational retail corporations and we spend more money in our own private loyal networks of home-based and mom-and-pop small businesses. So that's
fascinating to see what kind of results we're going to have, you know, once a system like that would be set up 6, 8, 10, 15, 20 months down the road.
Yeah.
Just like it is in Colorado right now with cannabis.
Now, ideally, I'm waiting for a network company, a network marketing company, to make a community currency at their source, at the level, so that when they sell a product or service, they could sell it. They could start off with a beta project and sell it at maybe, if they want to be conservative, 10% community currency and 90% cash. And if they're going to pay their commissions in the same ratio, everybody who participates wins, except the bank is cut out of the equation for that 10%.
It also seems to me that system, and I'm trying to envision it as you speak about it, it seems that it would also be so individualistic that it would hinder skimming at high levels.
Yeah. I mean, the whole network marketing industry is focused on decentralization of business. I mean, we went through the whole big cycle of centralization in the latter part of the 20th century with all these giant retail stores. But this industry, which I call the SDI industry or SDI profession, self-directed income profession, it's decentralizing. It's everybody's got their own little decentralized home-based business. And it's very good for the individual entrepreneurs. Gives everybody a chance to get in on the action.
And that way avoids the usury that is still in place and still is the policy of the supposedly free countries of the world.
And as a bonus, everybody who's in their own independent business, they have the right and the privilege to deduct a lot of expenses they cannot deduct if they're an employee working for an employer.
Oh, another bonus.
Another bonus.
Seems to me that when you're coming from truth, it just kind of works better.
It does, absolutely. It absolutely. Huh. And we've been fed lies, deceit, and deception on so many topics that when I hear one topic being lied about, I say, what else are they lying to us about and deceiving us on, you know?
Yeah. And as a Canadian right now, politically, what's your take on things? You can try to bring up usury to the conservatives, but they haven't said the word. So
let me take you back in history. 1993. Okay.
Sure.
John Tramiel was very successful operating his underground casino here in Ottawa. And John Tramiel launched a political party in 1993 called the Abolitionist Party of Canada. And our goal was to abolish interest or usury on the money. Now, most people never heard about it, but we ran 80 candidates in the 1993 federal election. I think it was 50 in Quebec and 30 in Ontario.
Huh.
And I was one of the candidates. John Tramiel was the leader of the party. We created our own community currency called abolitionist dollars. And we made a little bit of noise, but the mainstream media ignored us. But it was fun, and it was an experience. And who knows at what point in the future some political party will pick up the message and run with it. When the population is more educated, maybe they'll jump on board.
Well, are you familiar with the Canadian Action Party?
Yes, I was familiar with the Canadian Action Party also. And Paul Hellier, by the way, he just released a new book called The Money Mafia. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. Paul was we had a lecture of his on the show recently. It was a great speech that he gave in City Hall, Toronto.
Yeah. So, but the Canada Action Party, I'm not sure where they are right now because they went through some ups and downs, and I'm not sure whether they're duly registered yet or not.
Well, when you look at the website at the Canadian Action Party, and I don't have any affiliation with them, okay, right up front, but I've read it, and I just think, yeah, this is it. This totally makes sense, and nobody is moving on it. I mean, it's way crazy, even from the Green Party. You know, according to people's perceptions. But they really do focus on a way to get out of a lot of trouble.
There's a couple more political parties that are out there that have toyed with some ideas. That one is the Libertarian Party. Some of the Libertarians I know support what I'm talking about. And also the Freedom Party of Ontario is a local political party in Ontario. They certainly are aware of some of this stuff too. So who knows, at some point maybe. But on the other side of the coin, I say, what's important in 2014 and beyond is not who votes, but who counts the votes.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up.
Their voting machines are cheating. And there's many, many examples of that over the last few elections, whether it's in Canada, USA, or in Europe someplace. And so I always say, for these mainstream parties, it's always the same machine, different driver.
Yeah, how do we
so
get...
the machine never changes, but to keep changing drivers, then we think we got... democracy, it's an illusion.
We just believe that there is an honesty in the tallying of these votes on these machines. We just believe it.
Yeah.
There's a man who was recently sent to prison or is about to be sent to prison for a pretty ugly stretch of time, considering he's a fall guy. Michael, I think, Sona. This fella who was somehow or other connected with these illegal robocalls that the conservatives put out in the last election, which kind of, you know, invalidates their power. But this is the one guy who's going to jail, this little 23-year-old staffer who was told to do things, and he's actually taken the fall. And these cowards, these sick bastards, they're in there letting this guy – now, maybe that guy is a creep and whatever and, you know – supposed to go to jail, but honestly, after the electoral fraud of the previous probably two elections in Canada, but definitely the last one, the biggest thing that's going to happen is this guy goes to jail for whatever, this kid. You know,
they always pick a patsy and they pin it on the patsy and
such cowards. I mean, it's astoundingly ugly.
It is. I pretty much carry on working with promoting the usury-free community currency movement and tying it with the network marketing industry, or I call it the SDI industry. And like I did a series of seminars last week to celebrate our 10th annual usury-free week. We just do gatherings. We show videos. There's lots of videos available now that we can show and share and get people to get them re-educated on topics that they didn't know about. So that's my mission. My self-imposed mission is to keep on networking through in the internet and doing some live meetings and seminars, workshops, and consulting wherever I can, help people that want to be helped.
Tell me about the David Icke story.
Okay, let's go back to 1999. I met two women in Toronto who were under the business name of Sumeri Seminars, and they had already put in action a plan to invite David Icke to come to Canada and do some seminars in Toronto, Montreal, and Ottawa.
Okay.
So they asked me to help to promote his visit to Ottawa. So September 1999, I had a copy of a video, this is VHS way back then, of David Icke, and it was called Turning of the Tide. I think he made it about 1992 or 93, one of his first videos.
Oh, it's a video of him speaking in front of people or something?
Yes, okay. Speaking over in England at a group, and somebody videotaped it, and it got passed around, and I had a copy.
Okay.
So I ran an ad in a little magazine here in Ottawa called Tone Magazine, and I said, David Icke is coming for a seminar this weekend in Ottawa. And I said, if anybody wants to watch a video of him before he comes live, call me. And when I get six or eight people, I will show the video in my apartment. So I ran the ad, got the phone calls, got my six or eight people, invited them on a Wednesday night, or I think it was a Wednesday night, to show the video. So at 7 o'clock, the people came and I showed the video. Well, lo and behold,
so just to clarify, once again, to recap, you decided to show a personal VHS video to some friends of yours at your house.
I showed a personal video of David Icke speaking in England. It was on a VHS tape.
Right.
And it was called The Turning of the Tide.
Okay, to these friends in your house.
It's probably on YouTube now. Yeah, at my house. So they came in, sat in my chairs and sat on my couch. And in that invitation, I didn't know their names, okay, because I just ran an ad, and when I called them back, I said, it'll be at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, and I said, come. So I opened my door, and the people came and sat in my chairs and sat on my couch. Now, in that group who came was one particular man named Richard Warman. I didn't know who he was at the time. Now, the next morning, I'm teaching school, and I get a phone call at school from De La Salle High School, which we had booked and signed a contract with for David Icke to speak there in their auditorium on the weekend, on the Saturday and Sunday. He was doing a two-day seminar.
Okay.
I get a phone call from the school saying they had received faxes and emails and telephone calls that morning claiming David Icke was anti-Semitic and basically bad-mouthing David Icke. So they got scared and they canceled the contract. So we had to scramble around and find a second place. And lo and behold, this gentleman, Richard Warman, found out the location of the second place and caused it to be shut down. So here we are, this is Thursday. And then Friday morning, David Icke's flying into Ottawa Friday night, and we don't have a location yet until somebody in our circle finds a community college in Quebec. They're called CJEPs.
Yes.
So we found a CJEP in Quebec, and we kept it secret. We didn't tell anybody except those who had bought tickets where it was. And so that's how we had to do it so underhandedly to keep it quiet, because we knew if it got public, they'd probably close it down too. So lo and behold, Friday night, David Icke flies into Ottawa at the airport. And I'm supposed to pick him up at the airport, like when he flies in at 10 o'clock. And I'm waiting for his phone call, because he said, I'll call you when I'm ready, when I get through customs, so you haven't got to wait, and you can just come by and pick me up. So lo and behold, I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. I don't get a phone call from David Icke until after 1 a.m. on the Saturday morning.
Oh, so they detained him.
So when he got to immigration, he said there was a lady standing there with her arms folded, watching him walk down the ramp and pointing and saying, that's him. And they called him over to immigration, and they like basically harassed him for 3 hours, going through his computer, checking all his stuff, looking to find out if he was, quote, anti-Semitic or not, because of our Canada hate laws here are so draconian.
And sorry, when was this again?
This was back in September of 1999.
Okay.
So we're going way back.
Yeah, 15 years.
Yeah. And so lo and behold, David calls me after 1 o'clock in the morning, said, Tom, he says, you know, I'm finally through immigrations. Come and get me and take me to the hotel. So I did. And then we start our seminar on the Saturday morning at 9 o'clock on schedule. And on the seminar, David says, immigration has compelled me to go back to the airport at noon for another ongoing investigation. So lo and behold, he says, and there was about 100 people in the seminar, and he said, as many as you as possible, if you don't mind, I'd appreciate it if you'd drive your cars to the airport and stand outside the room where they're interrogating me, just so they know that people are watching what's going on. So I guess about 50 or 60 of us got in our cars and pooled our cars and drove to the airport and stood outside the room where he was being interrogated. They kept him another couple of hours. And then we all came back and he finished the seminar from 3 o'clock until about 9 in the evening. So that was the beginning of our experience with Richard Warman harassing David Icke in Canada. So that went on. Every time David Icke came to Canada from 1999 and 2000, 2001, when he came to Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa, he was harassed by demonstrations and by immigration harassing him all the time. So now, moving ahead to 2001, David Icke writes a book titled Children of the Matrix. In the book, a certain chapter around page 405, each title is a chapter, The Gatekeepers, and he identifies Richard Warman as a gatekeeper, and he describes basically how Richard Warman harassed him every time he came to Canada.
Richard Warman.
Now, Richard Warman was a lawyer at that time working for the Human Rights Commission in Ottawa. But for some reason—
The Canadian Human Rights Commission, like the government, body.
It's a quasi-court body in Ottawa that Richard Warman was working with at the time. And so when David Icke wrote his book, he basically took 4 or 5 pages to describe how he was being harassed by Richard Warman every time he came to Canada. And so in October 2002, Richard Warman creates a statement of claim against David Icke and myself and another 9 or 10 booksellers across Canada who were selling the book called Children of the Matrix. And it was a $1 million lawsuit, a civil suit. So that was in October of 2002. So David Icke has not come back to Canada to do a seminar or workshop since he got served that statement of claim 12 years ago.
Okay, just hold on a second there. I just want to flesh this out a bit more.
Yeah.
So you're saying that because what is written on page 405 or so to page 410 or so is what?
Is describing... David Icke describes how Richard Warman harassed him every time he came to Canada from 1999 until 2001.
Okay.
And Richard Warman calls that slander and libel and creates a civil lawsuit for $1 million involving David Icke, myself, and another 9 or 10 bookstores. And that court case was launched in October of 2002. And it only goes to trial now in February of 2015.
Okay, Tom, I got to stop you here. Is this a real story? Like, this sounds like craziness.
I know. It sounds like fiction, doesn't it?
This is a thing that actually happened because, yeah. Oh my God, this guy just dreaming up this, well, I'm going to charge up the, you know, this guy sounds insane.
Well, if anybody does a search on any search engine for Richard Warman, you'll find out that he is the instigator of many, many court cases all across Canada using Canada's hate laws involving human rights and outside of human rights.
And we're paying this guy to do this? This is a government job?
Well, he was, but I don't think he's still at Canadian Human Rights. I think he was back in 2002, but I don't believe he's there now. I don't know what his capacity is right now, but he's no longer at Canadian
Human Rights. Well, mentally diminished, to be sure, for starts. That's what his capacity is. God.
Anyway, just by dragging me into there over the last 12 years, I didn't get dismissed from the case until October 30th, 2014. There was a pretrial conference in Toronto, and I was there with David Icke's lawyer as the only two defendants left. The other booksellers have all disappeared over the last 12 years, and to my understanding, it's because bookstores have law firms and insurance companies attached to their business, and when they get a civil case, they simply sit down and negotiate with the plaintiff and come to some kind of money settlement to get their name off as a defendant.
Right. So if he wanted a certain amount, they'll dicker down and then say, okay, get lost.
Yeah. So that's why they all disappeared. But I had refused to pay him any money. And so I was still left there with David Icke as a defendant until October 30th, 2014, at which time I accepted an offer to settle where I paid Richard Warman no money, but I agreed to not sell the book, and I had a counterclaim against him, so I dropped my counterclaim, and he dropped his claim, and basically all that's left now is David Icke versus Richard Warman for this trial set for February the 2nd, 2015 at Ontario Superior Court in Toronto, Ontario, so Canada.
There's a trial coming up in Toronto. That's what you're saying.
It is a trial schedule, and the court has set aside 3 weeks for this trial to be held at Superior Court. I'm assuming it's on University Avenue there in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
And it begins on February the 2nd.
February 2nd.
2015.
2015, February 2nd, the big old courthouse in Toronto on University Avenue. There's going to be a trial there for David Icke.
That's right.
I said it like that, and I said it slowly because I don't imagine there'll be anything more than that in the mainstream press about this. But it's a pretty big deal. If you're a listener of the show and you're anywhere in the GTA or Ontario area or perhaps in upstate New York, if you can get through all of your snow, sorry about that, by the way, there's going to be a trial of David Icke in Toronto. This is a big deal because they hate this guy.
It is a big deal because it's about freedom of expression. I mean, it seems Richard Warman was censoring freedom of expression, and we need to fight for freedom of expression, or we need to, you know, we need to make sure our freedom of expression stays with us, because if we lose it, we lose a lot.
So you're not a lawyer, and we don't have lawyer-client privilege. So let me ask you, the gentleman that you were with when you were released of your charges, congratulations, by the way. I'm sure it's nice to have that 15-year-old headache removed.
It is.
After paying all the money you paid, but at least to get it done. So congrats. But you were speaking with the lawyer. And what exactly is the charge that we would expect to hear against David Icke at upcoming David Icke trial February 2015?
It's under Canada's defamation law, and it's under the section called slander and libel. Now, I don't know how Richard Warman can call it slander and libel when David Icke just basically explained how he was being harassed by this man every time he came to Canada. But Richard Warman calls that slander and libel. And Canada's defamation law is strange law. Anyway, it allows him to do this civil suit, and it allows him to collect money from all the defendants in the process. And David Icke and I refused to pay him money. So anyway, I'm out of it, but David Icke is not going to pay him money. He's going to go to trial, and hopefully he'll get justice in the system. But we'll
see. How much money are they looking for from him anyway?
It's a $1 million lawsuit, but David Icke is countersued. He has a countersuit also, so it's one versus the other.
He's actually going to fly here to a kangaroo court, most likely, that's going
to
railroad him.
He'll have to be here in person.
Wow.
From February the 2nd, and it's set aside 3 weeks.
So if he loses, then he'll owe this person $1 million, and then he just flies back to England or wherever he lives?
Well, whatever the judge does. I mean, usually these cases, even though the claim is $4 million, it's usually not. Usually, the judge doesn't. It's not that amount in the end, right?
Well, but, I just mean, is Canada going to do some kind of thing to detain him?
Oh, who knows? I don't think so, because even though they've always detained him, they've never found any reason why they've detained him. So he's always been let go.
Yeah.
So there's no reason. I mean, he's not anti-Semitic. He talks about the Rothschild banking empire, but Rothschilds happen to be Jewish, so that must be the connection.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to bring up, actually. That's you walked me right into that. Is the thing is about Icke, and sometimes, you know, people like anybody that seems to be on the side of, hey, let's justify this financial system. This is very unjust financial system. Let's make it more equitable. Every time someone like that comes along, inevitably, this person is going to wind up becoming branded an anti-Semite. And I don't understand how that always works. You know, it's like the people like Ezra Pound and, you know, people that see the scam of what's going on, the people that see the scam of what is going on and how they are doing what they're doing in the banking world, those people, that's who I'm talking about.
Well, it kind of paralyzes a lot of people, okay? Because to me, the ultimate label you can stick on somebody in the 21st century is call them anti-Semitic. So, like, when you tell somebody they're anti-Semitic, it makes them shiver in fear, and it's supposed to make you shut up and be quiet, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems to be used a lot, and it's tied in with the money, so I thought maybe you hit it on the head with that connection.
Well, I have to tell you this little sideline, that because I'm anti-usury, it has been suggested that that makes me anti-Semitic also.
Well, so that's what I mean. There's a tie in there. Anytime there you go. Thanks for putting a button on what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I mean. Like, you're about equitable finance, and then boom, you're an anti-Semite. Like, that's such a weird thing that is connected. Like, no one says, you know, if you're all about the environment, you know, if you're all about, like, hey, let's not spill oil or whatever, they don't go, oh, this guy's anti whatever. You know, yeah. they just call them tree huggers or whatever, but they don't call them anti something.
It seems to be an easy tie-in with the economic situation.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, well, that's a great story.
Anyway, so the bottom line is, it would be good to have anybody who can afford the time and effort to show up and sit in the courtroom and watch the proceedings, because I say the more ears and the more eyes watching, the better the outcome for a man like David Icke.
Oh, sure. I absolutely agree. I'd like to see how this unfolds myself. So thanks for telling us about it. And February 2nd, it feels like I'm plugging some kind of venue event, you know, but it's a court appearance. February 2nd in Toronto, the big courthouse, probably on University Avenue. Details to follow. I'll get on this. We'll talk about this.
Yeah.
Some more with some other folks. And so great. Well, thanks for telling us that. That's an excellent story. So you're free and clear now. Now you're set to do what with the time that you used to spend preparing yourself for this ridiculous trial that you're now free of. And you don't have to work on that anymore. What do you do with that time? Just work harder on.
I pretty much carry on working with promoting the usury-free community currency movement and tying it with the network marketing industry, or I call it the SDI industry. And like I did a series of seminars last week to celebrate our 10th annual usury-free week. We just do gatherings. We show videos. There's lots of videos available now that we can show and share and get people to. Get them re-educated on topics that they didn't know about. So that's my mission. My self-imposed mission is to keep on networking in the internet and some live meetings and seminars, workshops, and consulting wherever I can help people that want to be helped.
Great. Well, that's fantastic. Well, listen, Tom, thanks for coming on, and we'll definitely have you back sometime. Well,
thank you, Alan, for the opportunity.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.